And I'd ask you, let me ask you, counsel, before you start. There's a contract by seller to sell an interest in this development company. And to a fellow member or shareholder. The compensation for that, as I understand it, is a conveyance of a house in New Mexico. A payment of $150,000 to the ranch corporation. And what else? There's something else.
Well, there was the issue of indemnity, and there were two loans related to the homes that were guaranteed by the various partners, and so there was an indemnity undertaken by Mr. Wall to release Mr. Friedman or otherwise indemnify him for these two loans.
That relates to the house in New Mexico.
Well, there were actually three homes in New Mexico, Judge. There's one house that is Lot 42, Quay County, and that's the one that was to be conveyed to Mr. Friedman upon certain conditions. And then there were two other homes that were being built by Resort Custom Builders as the home building outfit for this development. And they were building those either on spec or for potential purchasers. But those other two homes had loans that were guaranteed by both Mr. Wall and Mr. Friedman and Mr. Hammond.
And you needed Mr. Friedman released from those, or Mr. Friedman was supposed to be released from those loans.
Yes, and one of the banks, of course, then did release them, and the other bank had said, well, we're not releasing them, but that loan remained current and that there was no liability as of that time. And so that's part of what we're here to talk about. So I understand that this... Well, I think that the legal issues I can state with some clarity, and we'll try to do so for you, the complexity of the facts arises because it's not just this contract that formed the relationship for all of these parties. As you also can see from the briefs, there was other litigation that didn't get consolidated into this case, and there were facts going on and legal arguments in those cases that do impact what's going on in this case. Thus, I think the judge tried to remedy some of that by saying, well, we'll stay some of the final outcome here until all that other litigation is resolved in recognition of that complexity. But our position is that ULR...
No, I don't want an argument. I just want to know what's going on here. That's all I want to know.
And what's going on is ULR is the overall developer. RCB, Resort Custom Builders, the party to this appeal and to this action, was the select builder for that development.
Counsel, I know we jumped in. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Yes. I assume you're not. I want to give him back his 15 minutes.
I think we'll be fine, Judge.
Okay.
I don't need the extra cases because I think that the briefs are concise and preside those issues. So I appreciate that. And so let me take my step back and say for the record, my name is Robert Bruce. My registration number is 17742. And may it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Winston Wall and Resort Custom Builders. And just as a summary of what I was saying regarding the facts of this case, the agreement here is basically a buyout agreement for Resort Custom Builders to buy back the interest of Barry Friedman and Mr. Wall, who is going to benefit from that by having an increased interest, did have some responsibilities. Mr. Hammond, the other owner of RCB, undertook no responsibilities relative to this contract. And RCB being the builder, ULR, a whole different party who may or may not be owed money, is the overall developer of this project down in New Mexico. And so with that background, I've brought to you today three different issues. The first issue relates to whether the court erred in awarding a judgment to plaintiff for specific performance of this $150,000 that is allegedly owed to ULR. We believe that ULR can and should be responsible for its own ability to collect its money if that is due.
Counselor, can I interrupt you? What do you do about Rule of Civil Procedure 17A? Which I don't think anybody cited. It specifically says the party with whom or in whose name a contract is made for the benefit of another may sue in his own name without joining the other. Isn't that exactly what happened here?
Well, I don't think that that's what happened here. I think that what had happened here is that they said there was $150,000 due on the books, and by the time that came around that there was a defense to that action. Remember what I had cited in the pleadings here is that there was nothing in the complaint And not until the eve of trial that we find out that there's going to be discussion of the $150,000.
That's not, well, let's talk about that. And I guess my thought is, and I, by all means, try to persuade me here, it seems to me this was tried by implied consent, another doctrine I don't think either of you cited. The issue was raised in the summary judgment brief. You responded on the merits. The issue in both of your trial management orders, and you each submitted one, this was listed as an issue for trial. You both put on evidence of this issue at the trial, and the court ruled on it. How is that not tried by implied consent in this case?
Well, that's just because it has been brought up. I don't think it would be unwise for me not to respond in a brief, but it certainly wasn't part of the claims that was pled. And I think that that's why we had some confusion in the result of this. Are we talking about something under Rule 17A, a direct claim, or are we talking about a third-party beneficiary issue, which is what the judge, at the conclusion of the evidence, asked us to brief? And I think the judge was looking at it from her mind at the time as, is this a third-party beneficiary issue, not a right to sue on somebody else's behalf issue?
But counsel, if you hadn't wanted it to be part of the case, you could have easily said, Judge, this is not part of the case. Let's not try this piece. When you don't say anything and go ahead and go to trial on it, it's tried by agreement or by consent, isn't it?
Well, Judge, I disagree. I thought that when we were going to trial, that the focus of this case was going to be on the Lockwood II issue and then on the indemnity issue.
But if it's mentioned in the trial management order, including in your version of it, it's going to trial, right?
Well, I understand, and I'm not saying that it wasn't something that's legitimate because it's in the four corners of this document. But what I'm saying is that the analysis on the issue is something that where there was error, because we believe that there, Mr. Friedman, while he is a member of ULR, just as Mr. Wall and Mr. Hammond are, that that entity ought to be protecting its own self and standing up for its own defenses.
Can I ask you, Mr. Bruce, wasn't the URL payment consideration under this agreement? And I guess Judge Roy asked you about this. I mean, it seemed to me part of the consideration Mr. Friedman was getting was this conveyance of the property in New Mexico and that you're going to pay ULR, which I think Mr. Friedman owned. Isn't that the consideration for the agreement? And if so, doesn't Mr. Friedman have a right to say, I didn't get the consideration promised under the agreement?
Let me take one step back.
Please.
The little factual correction I'd like to make to your question, judges, is that Mr. Friedman owns ULR. He's the majority owner, but Mr. Hammond owns some, and Mr. Wall, either 10 or 5%, depending upon how this all happens.
Thank you.
So it's sort of mixing around money in different pockets. I can understand that. But I don't think that it was a matter of his consideration. It was, this is what's shown on the books, and it should be paid on that date. But there was nothing in the testimony that Mr. Wall said, he said, it's unpaid. But the argument was, is it's admittedly due, but it's not necessarily due. If it's not due, then how can that be additional consideration? It has to have been due before it can be paid. And that's what's the subject of all this other litigation. Not that alone, but that's one of the things that need to be resolved. And we think that that should be heard in a direct dispute between RCB and ULR.
I can't remember, Mr. Bruce, did you actually make that argument? You made that argument in this case, too, right, that there was the other litigation and it wasn't due? You presented that evidence to this judge?
We made that argument. I think the evidence will be much more detailed in the New Mexico case that's pending between RCB and ULR.
What difference does it make whether it was due under whatever prior obligation may or may not have existed if it was agreed in this agreement that it would be paid?
Well, I guess that's a different reading of the agreement, Judge, and the way I read the agreement is that it was a condition precedent that it had to be due. I didn't understand this agreement, and I don't think my client understood this agreement as a waiver of arguments that RCB may have against ULR.
So this was an agreement to litigate the issue? I mean, there is an obligation to pay it, or there isn't an obligation to pay it.
You're saying
there's no obligation under the contract to pay it.
If there is a defense to it being paid between the two parties who are making...
Outside the contract.
Yes. If there's a defense, I think that defense is still valid and should be not waived just because they...
This is Mr. Friedman's claim. I'm going to call him the seller because I can never keep track of names. This is the seller's claim now, right, under the contract.
Yes.
Now, does the contract say it will be paid when otherwise due? Or does it say it'll be paid?
It says that 2 years it will be paid, that it's shown on the books, and in 2 years it will be paid. However, we paid to ULR.
So what? I can buy a house, I can sell a house to you and say, pay the proceeds to my daughter. Can I?
You can say that.
And isn't that a binding obligation on you to pay the proceeds to my daughter?
But I think that there's a distinction between your example here, Judge, and what really happened here, because they were relying upon the books of ULR, and the books of RCB was what was owed. And it turns out, it's our position that wasn't owed and never should have been owed, and that's what's part of the other litigation.
But the problem with that, Mr. Bruce, is that's not what the contract says. I have it. It is agreed that the RBC books show an amount payable to ULR, $150,000. RCB will pay this sum in 2 years from the date of this agreement. I mean, I don't see how you say you can dispute whether it was due. It's RCB will pay this sum in 2 years.
To ULR?
Yes.
Not to Mr. Friedman.
Okay.
But ULR hadn't bought the claim.
And let me bring back my question. I wouldn't do this, but I sell my house to you. Make the check payable to my daughter. You're saying I can't enforce that?
Yes, but I have the right to bring up all of those defenses. And those defenses were brought into this case not because of my choosing. I tried to consolidate it all, and we made out there.
Well, you agree to pay it to my daughter. You understand? You signed the contract, but you're going to pay the proceeds to my daughter.
Right, but if I have otherwise defenses between set off.
Let's say you have a set off against me from some business transaction. So what?
What if I have a set off against your daughter?
So what?
Then I think that I wouldn't have to pay it because I've still got the right to argue set off.
So what?
Why can't you argue? Why didn't you file something in this lawsuit saying you had a set off?
Well, I think that that's what I tried to do with the consolidation. And
yeah, but even without the consolidation, you can still assert set-off as an affirmative defense.
That's true, and I don't believe that the set-off, I can't remember the pleading whether that was in there, but it certainly wasn't argued at the trial. This has been a good discussion, I appreciate it. I just wanted to mention this issue on the good faith and fair dealing. And this is just something I think that in the findings of fact and conclusions of law issue, it just got missed, and I'm not saying the judge did anything wrong other than it had some complications in this case. As we all see, it's factually complicated. But when the judge deleted the finding that there was a breach of the good faith and fair dealing, I think that there should have also been a deletion of the conclusion that there was a loss of the 5%. The evidence in this case was that there was the release and that there hasn't been any payment to Heartland Bank that would have justified the loss of the 5% to Mr. Wall. And thus, we just think that there should be either a remand to the judge to reconsider that issue, to conform the factual findings with the conclusion, or a reversal, because it just seems like that got missed, in my opinion.
If I can ask you about that one, Mr. Bruce, it seems to me your colleague agrees that this was an error, that the court intended that you won the implied covenant argument. It seems that that's agreed, and I think it's Mr. Kreutz, you can correct that. But assuming that's true, The conclusion does say, based upon the breach of agreement, as well as a breach of the implied covenant fair dealing, the 5% has to be paid. Why could we not affirm here on the ground? I mean, I think the court's intent was clear that the 5% payment was a remedy for both. She wrote it, both of the breach of the agreement and the breach of the implied covenant. Why could we not affirm on the ground that it's a proper remedy for the breach of the agreement?
Because the judge has granted all the remedy that was asked for on all the other claims. The only claim on the 5% related to the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And so I can't see how you can go to trial on that as your claim. You win on that claim, but you still lose. That leaves me about 2 minutes, and if I can save those for rebuttal, Your Honor.
That's fine.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jim Kreutz, 4752.
I'm sorry for mispronouncing your name, Mr. Kreutz.
Pardon me?
I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
No problem. It happens quite often.
Do you agree with the facts as counsel presented them at the beginning of his statement?
Not specifically. I think that what counsel's done is brought in other matters that are not part of this record, and I don't think that's appropriate. He brought it forth in his brief talking about other cases and these other cases filed in New Mexico and other cases filed in Colorado. That's not part of the record. Also, it appears that counsel's argument is, well, we have a case against Ute Lake Ranch, and that's a defense to the $150,000. Well, it's not a defense, it's a setup. And I think Judge Atrum recognized that when she said, we can't collect on $150,000 until those cases are resolved because there may be a setup. So it's a non-issue. In fact, I venture to say that the appeal is a non-issue. The only issue was the breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and had counsel called me, we'd have stipulated to that I think the judge erroneously included that in her decision by marking it out in the conclusion. So I said, I think since she marked it out in her conclusion, that it was an error to include it in the decision, and I agree.
Do you think it's a scrivener's error?
Pardon me?
Do you think it's a scrivener's error, the fact that that language appears in that paragraph?
Do I think that's what? I'm sorry.
A scrivener's error, just a mistake of the author.
Yes, I think it's a mistake of the judge that basically I said in my brief that we would acquiesce to the claim that the breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing is not part of her decision because of that strikeout. So what I'm saying is that leaves the other two issues, which I submit are groundless. The issue is a contract case.
Before you move on, Mr. Kreutz, on that, would you address Mr. Boots's answer to my last question to him about this 5%? He said that this 5% issue only related to breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing and not to the breach of agreement itself. No. Would you respond to that?
I will. Let me... that 5% is, I don't have the contract in front of me right now, but that 5% provision, as I understand it, had to do with the compliance with the contract. It had nothing, there's no language in the contract that says a violation of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. We all know that that's an inherent provision in all contracts, but it has to be found separately with regard to a claim. And we already waived that claim for you, but I don't think the 5% relates to that claim of breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing at all.
You think it's not? Okay, that's right. And I have it in front of me.
And the contract talks to that. This is a simple contract case. I don't know why it's being confused. Mr. Well admitted he owed $150,000 and didn't pay it. Mr. Friedman said $150,000 was part and parcel of their discussion and negotiation on arm's length. There was no dispute. At the time we filed a complaint, it was not due. They paid the $70,000 in February 2009, which you might say is an acknowledgement that they're required to comply with the terms of this agreement, and didn't pay. And why didn't they pay? Mr. Wall said, and it's in the court's order, we have insufficient funds. what are we talking about here? I didn't pay it because I don't have money. I mean, that's use 15B or whatever equitable remedies outside of Rule 15B. All that evidence came into the court. There was no opportunity to defend the $150,000 by saying, no, we're going to file a counterclaim, or no, we have consideration somewhere else. Mr. Wall, what the court said, charter facts, we have sufficient funds. They haven't complied with anything under this contract.
It does not. Has your client conveyed his interest in RBC?
Yes. Yes, and Mr. Wall testified to that. In fact, at the, as I recall, the opening of his testimony, he said he conveyed it, and now I have 50%, Mr. Hammond has 50%. So that's the consideration. And by the way, that was not just some slight consideration. At the time that was done, RCB had 118 reservations for building of homes at that time. And so they had a great opportunity. They had reservations were, by the way, on land that was controlled by a company called UCAR, not Ute Lake Ranch. Ute Lake Ranch Inc. was filing one. This particular project that we're talking about here, where RCB had the 118 reservations, was filing two. So I just want to clarify that.
The reservations, you mean commitments to buy?
Yes.
To buy lots or buy homes?
Written commitments. As you know, they take reservations prior to the plat because they can't take contracts. And then once they get the plat approval, then they go back to those people and say, do you want to go through with the contract? And they sign up for the contract. So what I'm saying is there was no small consideration. Mr. Friedman is a developer, he's not a builder. So I thought, I'm not in the building business, let them do it. But he did want to protect his company of which Mr. Wall is a shareholder, if you will, and Mr. Hale is a shareholder. And so when we talk about protecting the company, getting $115,000 that was owed, you know, it in essence benefit them as well as a shareholder. Now, if they have some other claim out there in New Mexico, and I'm familiar with that suit because I'm an attorney on that suit, but it's another frivolous claim as far as I'm concerned. But it's not for hearing at this time, even though it's included in his brief, and it's kind of his reason why we don't owe the $150,000. He said he owed, and he said he didn't pay it because we don't have the money.
Can I ask you, Mr. Cruz, the procedure is just a little odd to me. Why did you file, I gather, you said you're the attorney in the other case. I mean, why did you file on behalf of ULR in the other case and then pursue the same issue here? That's a little odd.
First of all, the other case was subsequent to this case, right?
Okay.
And the other case, and that, you know, since you brought it up, I'll advise it. The other case in New Mexico is RCB and seven lot owners filed suit against Ute Lake Ranch, Mr. Friedman, for rescission of their contract. Because RCB owns some lots in filing one that I described to you a while ago. So that's what that lawsuit's about. And
so the other side commenced that suit, and you brought the claim on behalf of ULR as a counterclaim? Is that right?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Not at all. No, this is a standalone. This case.
No, I understand that, but I gather there's a separate lawsuit in which ULR is seeking the $150,000.
No, that's not.
Okay, I misunderstood.
No.
All right. My apologies.
Mr. Kurtz, I have a different question for you. Do you see any reason not to do a limited remand to Judge Antrim to have her tell us whether the excision of the statement about breach of the implied covenant in good faith and fair dealing in her order, in paragraph 3 of her order, whether that, you know, if we take that out, would it change the result of her order? Do you see any problem with doing a limited remand
No.
for that purpose?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think it changed it at all. It's a breach of contract.
I don't think you understood Judge Terry's question. It's something I also grappled with. I understand your position. It doesn't change the contract. You think we can just excise the take out the words implied covenant. I think Judge Terry's question is, should we remand it to Judge Antrim to ask whether that was her intent?
I think I stipulated to it. I don't know why we do a remand.
But the question is whether Judge Antrim intended that the same remedy apply to the breach of contract claim, I think.
I can't look into her mind.
But do you see any problem?
That whole paragraph, I guess I would say she clearly meant that not to be part of the claim. And we know that I drafted she asked us both to draft proposed findings and conclusion and decision. And I drafted it, and perhaps as evidenced by some of the markings, what have you, she, I think, overlooked that. So I'm going with it. I'd like to say, well, she made a mistake crossing it out, you know, but I'm not even saying that. I'm just saying, okay, because why? It's a breach of contract. It's a very simple breach of contract. I was admitted by the defendants that we didn't do this, we didn't do this, we didn't do this. And in fact, to add one more thing, as you recall, they're required to indemnify Mr. Friedman against Heartland Bank. Heartland Bank has now sued Mr. Friedman, and they're not indemnifying. And they're not. They don't comply with anything. There's no intent to. It's just that simple. And I think one thing, there's some question about, should we pay ULR or can they convey the property of in New Mexico? Well, this is not a quiet title. It's not a lien case. It's not a 107. It's not a foreclosure. It's a contract. You know, certainly the court can order. You said you were going to convey it. Convey it. I mean, I don't care where it is. It could be in England, for all I care. The court certainly has the authority to make that decision, regardless of the issue involved. It's a and I think the third party, I think the courts have addressed that. Judge Roy, I think, addressed it on his analogy. My analogy is, you know, if I agree to, build a doghouse and give me $500, dog doesn't have to join the case. I mean, I can sue you for the doghouse that I contracted for. I do not understand their argument. I think that their argument is groundless, and There's no basis whatsoever, and it's a clear case of this defendant not complying with anything with respect to this contract, and no intention of complying, quite frankly. And that's the sad state of affairs. And to say, well, now we have to retry it for this and retry it for that, it's enough litigation already. I think it's clear. So, any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge, we heard some things about what is and isn't in the record. I think we need to stick to the record. I thought that I had. And reference other litigation that is in the record by way of those motions to consolidate. What's not on the record is suits by Heartland Bank and what may or may not be indemnity. What is in the record appears at number 6 on page 2 of 7 of the court's ruling, which specifically says plaintiff has not been required to make any payments on this loan, referring to the Heartland Bank loan. Defendants have held plaintiffs harmless. And so the issue is, how is that a breach of contract, which is the only basis that I think that you can sustain the court on that second issue of implied covenant and good faith and fair dealing. With that specific language that the judge wrote in there, you can't affirm on the breach of contract language because the judge, as a factual matter, has said there was no breach on that issue. So if you deal with the implied covenant.
Had Mr. Friedman been sued by Heartland Bank at the time of that court order?
No.
So counsel's also alluding to things that are not in the record.
Correct. That was my point, is 2 years later, there may be some further discussion on all this and more litigation between all these parties because they decided not to do it in one deal. And that's just the way it is sometimes. But my point being is, because of what was written and what factual finding you have, there's not a basis for upholding that implied covenant of good faith dealing argument, even if we call it a breach of contract argument. And just to respond to your question, I think a limited remand is appropriate under that Murray versus Rock case that I did cite, because that's what they did in that case, said, you know, there are these issues in your order, you need to remand and try to fix them to bring that clarity out.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bruce, I guess I'm confused. The issue we're talking about in this 5% says, Wall hereby pledges a 10% interest, blah, blah, blah. The pledge shall be reduced to 5% as soon as Friedman is released from either the First Community Bank debt or the Heartland Bank debt. That's what we're talking about here. Was Friedman released from either of those debts?
Yes, look at the number 6 in the conclusion, or the factual findings, 2 of 7 in the court's order. Released from First Community Bank loan and no fully indemnified.
Okay, so the pledge, there was the release from these loans. Therefore, the pledge must be reduced to 5% as soon as given that release, right?
The release is for his benefit. He only gets reduced to 5% if he doesn't indemnify or release. The issue is whether he owns 10% of this company. And if he complies with this release provision, he owns 10%, not 5, or reduced down to 3.
But it says the pledge shall be reduced as soon as Friedman is released, period. You just admitted to me Friedman was released, so the contract says it shall be reduced, and that's what the court ordered.
Judge, I don't think that that's what the intent was. I don't have it right in front of me, but the idea was Winston Wall has 10% of this company, ULR. He could only go down to 5 why would he reduce his interest? He would only get reduced if he was unable to release or indemnify Heartland Bank and Community Bank. And he's done that, and that's the court's finding. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank both counsel for their briefs and argument. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.